Hey guys, I'm your host, Tara A. Devlin, and welcome to this week's episode of Koobana, True Japanese Scary Stories from Around the Internet. Have you picked up Koobana Volume 9 yet? It's available now. If you're ready for another terrifying round of scares straight out of Japan, head over to Amazon and pick up your copy right now. We've got shrines, curses, ghosts, angry ancestors, abandoned buildings, terrifying schools, and much more, so don't miss out. This week, we're looking at a few tales that feature interesting encounters with rather unique characters. First up is a boy by the name of Tadokuro-kun. What's so special about him? Well, he tells interesting scary stories, but that's not where this one ends. Not even close. Find out why in Tadokuro-kun. Tadokuro-kun and I were in the same class from the 5th grade until the end of the summer holidays of the 6th grade. He was a smart kid who called the library his citadel, and he always read way too many books and already had glasses. He liked mystery novels, and I remember him telling me about all of the interesting books in the library a lot. He owned the triple crown of glasses, being gloomy, and being a nerd. That alone would have been enough to make him the target of bullying, but he also had an unsurpassable, unique talent. He was really, really good at telling scary stories. Not only that, but they were all his original creations. Looking back on it now, he might have heard the stories somewhere else, or maybe he changed other stories into horror tales, but still, he was an elementary school student. Everyone always looked at him in awe as he told these scary stories like a never-ending water fountain. He always said the stories were his own creations, so it wasn't like he pretended to be one of those people who can see ghosts or was haunted himself or anything like that. This is a story I came up with. Whenever Tadokuro-kun started a story like that, the whole class would fall silent in an instant. The rest of us kids called him the Great Scary Story Master. We added the great because it meant we respected him even more than the teachers at school. It was a rather odd nickname that only elementary students could come up with, and we mostly called him just Great for short. So, there were only two times that Tadokuro-kun told stories that weren't his own creation. We were in the 5th grade at the time, and perhaps thanks to his influence, there was a horror boom across the entire school. At first, all the kids held, like, scary story meetings every lunchtime. Then, Kokuri-san got popular. And then, finally it reached fever pitch with fortune-telling. After school, kids visited abandoned houses and graveyards for tests of courage, and many kids didn't return home until well after dark. But this soon became a big problem. More and more parents complained, and of course, the teachers soon took action. Thanks to that, the horror boom came to a sudden halt, but there was still no end to the number of kids asking Tadokuro-kun to tell scary stories. When he realized that not only the teachers but the parents would get upset at him, Tadokuro-kun then told his first non-fake story. And that story was, to put it simply, about belief in the power of words. When I tell a story, do you know why the first thing I say is, "This is a story I came up with"? Then you all think, "Ah, this story is fake, right?" Well, this is actually very important. Everyone was like, "Huh?" It was different to his usual way of telling a story. Of course, I felt the same way as well. But Tadokuro-kun continued regardless. There's a belief that words can bring about reality. The characters used to write this mean the spirit of words, but it means that if you speak words with strong intent, then those words will possess power. For example, Takeshi-kun, alias, often jokingly says to me, "Die, right?" But let's suppose that he really, really hated me, despised me, that he really wanted me to die. Then he would yell, "Die!" at me with all of his feelings behind that word. Then the strong feelings attached to those words would come in my direction, and then, once those words reach me, I die. I'm killed by words. At this point, Takeshi-kun nearly wet himself, but the rest of us laughed and jumped around. "Words can't kill you," we screamed. "Of course not. If Tadokoro-kun was right, then there would be funerals and people dying every day. Our school would be one dangerous place to be." "The only reason it doesn't happen is because no one is serious about it." Well, that's one way of thinking of it. And those feelings, they don't even have to be your own. They can be someone else's. That's why I always purposefully say, "I thought this up," at the beginning. We stared at him blankly. We had no idea that was why he said those things. "Do you remember my story about the group of dolls? What did you think about it when you heard it?" We had heard that story just recently, so most people remembered it. There were some kids who were playing with a popular doll and mistakenly put it in their mouths and choked to death, so they were recalled from sale just in case. Yet most of the recalled dolls were impressed with the sad feelings of the kids who had suddenly had them taken away, or the desire to play with the dolls even more, so these feelings combined with the spirits of the dead children to form a grudge of loneliness. And then, night after night, this mass of dolls would visit the homes of their former owners, and when they were done playing, they would suffocate the children so they would no longer be lonely. That story was pretty scary, but in the end it was just a fake story that Todokoro-kun came up with. We didn't want to look like weaklings like Takeshi-kun, so we were like, but it was just a fake story anyway. And that's what I'm trying to say. If I had instead told you, "This story is real," then what would you have thought? "I wonder if that could happen to my doll." Or maybe, "I hope they don't come and visit me. Will the doll I threw away do the same thing?" You'd be worried, right? Because that was a true story. There's no way to say that maybe the same won't happen to your dolls either. Nobody said a thing in response. All of us exploded with anxiety. Wait, that was a true story? Was he being for real? Did that mean that all the stories he had told up until that point were true as well? I didn't know what to think. "Ah, don't worry. That doll story really was fake. But that anxiety you felt just now, it gives power to that story. If it's only one or two people, then not much will come of it. But if it's 10 or 20 or hundreds, everyone full of worry and anxiety, wondering if it might really happen to them, then it all gathers into one mass of feelings. And if that attaches itself to my story, do you know what will happen? That group of dolls, which until then was fake, becomes real. The more you think it might really happen, then the better the chance that it really does. That's why I always say they're fake stories first." After listening to Tadokoro-kun's "not fake" story, our hearts and minds became one. That was terrifying. It was like being told that the more afraid you are of a scary story, the more likely it is to become true. Thinking about it now, I think it didn't really have anything to do in the belief of the power of words, and that was, in its own way, a fake story as well. But rather, we were more frightened of the fact that if you really are scared of something, then it might actually happen. Tadokoro-kun's "not fake" story soon spread throughout the entire school. Of course it did. Now people knew the real reason why he only told fake stories, and that if people were afraid of them, then they would become real. And with that, the school's horror boom came to a complete stop. That was the first of Tadokoro-kun's not-fake stories. The horror boom stayed gone after that, and we entered the sixth grade. Now, although the boom had died down, it wasn't like we stopped telling scary stories entirely, and our class still enjoyed Tadokoro-kun's stories every now and then. Kids would often come from other classes to listen as well. There were no major problems, and the teachers didn't mind, as long as we stayed in the classroom after school. Then, the end of our final summer vacation at elementary school arrived. Tadokoro-kun got sick towards the end of the holidays and was missing for about a week at the start of the second semester. "Hey, don't you be trying to make your holidays longer while we're all at school," I remember everyone saying with a laugh. But anyway, he came back after a week and we got to talking about the fun we'd have after school that day. We all gathered in the classroom like always and told stories about our holidays and listened to Tadokoro-kun's scary stories. The story he told us this time was the story of the lid. It went a little something like this. An elementary school student visited his grandparents alone for the summer holidays. Although they lived in the countryside, it wasn't a poor village. It was actually rather prosperous. For his summer self-study, this student intended to investigate the various shrines and temples in the area, and so he visited them all in turn. When he visited a shrine at the top of a small hill on the outskirts of town, the student found something strange at the rear of the temple. It was a lid made of wood. It was about 150 centimeters in diameter, and judging by all of the dirt on it, it was rather old. It was unexpectedly heavy when he picked it up, and rather sturdy as well. It was about 10 centimeters thick, and seemed to be made from several pieces of wood stacked together. On the top, he could see the wood grains, but on the bottom, it was black for some reason. "If there's a lid, then there must be a hole for it," the student thought, and searched the immediate vicinity. But he could find nothing, and when he had given up and decided to go home, it occurred to him that he should look inside the shrine itself. That idea appeared to be the correct choice, and inside he found another lid the same size. It had been put up above the altar, and it was surrounded by several layers of sacred rope. The student was curious as to what the lid was for, and so he went inside and approached it. However, the lid was only propped up on the altar and wasn't actually covering anything. The student, brimming with curiosity, ducked under the sacred ropes and looked behind the lid. Although it was dim, there he found a metal disc about the same size as the lid stuck to it. This metal plate also appeared to be rather old, and it was black with oxidization. It looked to be either copper or bronze. The student was curious about what the metal plate could be, so he tried to remove it from the lid. But they were stuck well and wouldn't budge. Giving up, the student decided to take a photo to at least remember what he'd seen, and sketched a picture in his sketchbook. After he returned home, the student got the photos developed, but there was no photo in there of the metal plate. When he asked the store what was going on, they explained that there were several photos that came out entirely black. Judging by the order he took the photos, he realized they were the ones he took of the plate. The student forced them to develop those black photos as well. After that, the student was troubled by dreams. In his dreams, he tried to pry that metal plate off the lid, just like he did in real life, but it just wouldn't come off. He kept trying and trying, even when his nails peeled off, but he would be unable to and then, eventually, woke up. With each passing day, the boy became more and more curious about what that metal plate was. One night, as he was dreaming about his struggle with the lid yet again, he realized something was different. The lid had shifted just slightly. The boy was elated. Finally, it was time to figure out what it was. He tried as hard as he could to move it further, but It wouldn't budge any more than that. But every night after that, whenever he dreamt, that lid opened a little more, bit by bit. Unable to hide his excitement, he tried night after night to open it. Even when he was awake, all he could think of was the lid, and he forgot all about his summer homework as well. When he was awake, all he did was stare at the black photos or try to sketch pictures of the metal plate. Then, finally, the other side of the metal plate appeared. The boy was elated and pulled the lid as hard as he could. And what do you know? The lid, that up until that point hadn't even budged, came right off. The boy stared at the other side of the metal. It was just a black metal plate, but it was so dark that it looked like it might suck him in. The boy reached his hand out to touch it. At that moment, he heard something ringing in his ears. It was a small voice, muttering something over and over. It appeared to be coming from the metal, and the boy placed his ear closer to hear it better. "Open up, open up, open up, open up, open up." It sounded like it was saying, "Open up." Surprised, the boy tried to step away, but he couldn't. On the contrary, the coldness of the metal against his ear disappeared. The very next moment, two dark red arms appeared out of the pitch black surface and grabbed his head. Unable to fight back, the boy was sucked into the metal plate. Then, he woke up. Once the boy was awake, he was no longer afraid. But he really, really wanted to see that metal plate for real again, not just in his dream. He had already been consumed by it. Of that, he was sure. It hadn't budged at that time, but now it would open. He had opened it in his dream, so he could open it now. He fully believed that. He didn't have to wait for his dreams anymore. The boy, unable to think of anything but that metal plate, snuck away from his parents and to the shrine. And just like that, he was never seen again. Whether he was dragged into the metal plate like in his dream, or if something else happened, nobody knew. And in the end, nobody knew just what that metal plate was either. The only person who did was the elementary school boy who disappeared. What made Tadokoro-kun's story so interesting was that, even though it was fictional, not everything was made clear by the end. The tale of the lid ended with the metal plate still a mystery. Once the story was done, we all excitedly chatted about what that metal plate might have been. Most people thought that it was a mirror that connected to another world. Not the other side, but hell itself. No, it connected to the spiritual world. No, it wasn't a mirror, but a warp in space and time. We enjoyed thinking up all sorts of possibilities. However, and I don't know why this was, but everyone felt a little uneasy with that story afterwards. It was soon followed by the happening that made Tadokoro-kun a legend. The next day, he didn't come to school. He'd just had a week off because he was sick, so we all thought that maybe he was ill again. But he didn't come to school the next day, or the day after that either. We were worried that he was really sick, so we went to the teacher and asked if we could go visit him. But the teacher shook his head. "Tadokoro-kun is in no state for visits right now," he said. We were shocked. Was he really that bad? So then, did he force himself to come to school that day? People speculated all sorts of things. Then, after he'd been missing for 2 weeks, the teacher finally told us the truth. Tadokoro-kun had been missing since the day he told us the tale of the lid. Our teacher also didn't know the full details because his parents didn't want to talk about it. But apparently, on that same day he told us the story, he didn't return home, and nobody had seen him since. The police were already investigating, and it was possible that he had been kidnapped. The last anyone had seen of him was at a nearby station that same evening. Where on earth had Tadokoro-kun gone? A month passed since that last sighting of him near the station, and police abandoned the search as well. Tadokoro-kun's family seemed to be in agreement with them. But we knew where he was. It was stupid, but we also knew there could be no other explanation. I noticed it after school on the day our teacher told us that Tadokoro-kun was missing. That day, the investigation switched to an open investigation, and because there was the possibility of kidnapping, all of us kids were sent home that afternoon with classes cancelled. We all went home first, and then gathered at a nearby park immediately after. Everyone was quiet, unsure of what to do in the face of the reality that someone we knew had gone missing. We spoke a little about him, and then everyone there at the time realized something. When Tadokoro-kun told us the tale of the lid, he didn't start it like he usually did. That was the source of the discomfort we all felt at the time. He didn't start it with, "This is a story I came up with." When we realized that, everyone was in agreement, like, "Ah, so that's what it was." It was a true story. The student in the story was Tadokoro-kun himself. And just like in the story, he went missing as well. Our great scary story master had become a scary story himself. Thinking about it, I was strangely not sad. "He really is great, huh?" someone said. Those words spoke for us all. Tadokoro-kun's final scary story was about himself. Then he became a legend. And that was the second, not fake, story he ever told. 20 years have passed since then, and Tadokoro-kun still hasn't been found. His parents moved away soon after that, so I was never able to ask them if his grandparents lived in the countryside, or if he had those photos and sketches. It's a bit of an out there explanation, but looking back on it now, with full respect to him, I think his disappearance honestly was because of that metal plate. Whenever we have a reunion of our old classmates, we always make sure to say, "To the greatest, who became his own scary story." Next up is a young girl by the name of Kiyomi-chan. She's a little eccentric, but her friend doesn't think much of it until several decades later, when she realizes something more may have been at play here. Find out why in Kiyomi-chan. This happened when I was in the third grade of elementary school. There was a girl in my class by the name of Kiyomi-chan that I was good friends with. We used to go and play at each other's houses every day after school together. One day, we were sitting at her kitchen table reading Doraemon together. In the story, Doraemon gave Nobita something like a cutout from a picture book. There were things like cakes, sweets, even cars, and these cutouts could be assembled and eaten and driven just like the real thing. "That's so cool," we both said. "We should try it out." And so, we got some paper, scissors, and coloured pencils out. Of course, we were old enough to know that they wouldn't turn into the real thing, but it was still fun to play around. Then, as the sun started to set, it was time for me to go home. Kiyomi-chan saw me off like she always did at the front door. And then she said something. "Buruburu-chan, let's not forget what happened today, even once we grow up." I was used to her saying strange things like that out of the blue, but something about her seemed a little different at the time, so I asked her why. Looking back on it now, there was definitely something different about Kiyomi-chan that day. She continued, "Today, I'm 32 years old." She was making even less sense. But still she continued. It's 2002. I'm 32. When I thought about it, my mind flew all the way back to when I was a child. To be brutally honest, I wasn't exactly the smartest kid. I'm still not now, either. And I didn't know why, but the year 2002 seemed so far away, like the distant future. All I could think was, if they had flying cars and such then. Huh. So you're from Doraemon's future then? All I could do was give a stupid response. Kiyomi-chan smiled at me. Not at all. It's different to the manga world, she said. We said our goodbyes and then promised to play again the following day. When I think about it now, I regret that I didn't ask her more questions. But I was a kid after all, and both Kiyomi-chan and I loved Doraemon, so we were into all sorts of sci-fi stuff. We even dreamed about it. So I honestly didn't find what she said to be that strange at the time. When I went to school the next day, Kiyomi-chan spoke to me like always. She was her regular, normal self. Over time, I entirely forgot what she said that day, and the days passed in a blur. Then we started the fifth grade, and at the same time, I moved away. And just like that, I never saw Kiyomi-chan again. Then, this year, 2002, I turned 32. Then it hit me. I remembered what Kiyomi-chan said that day. Maybe. I moved around a lot after that day, and now I live overseas. I'd like to track Kiyomi-chan down, but if she got married, then she probably has a different last name now, so I'm not sure how I can find her. Back then, I was raised by my mother alone, which was pretty rare at the time, and people didn't look fondly upon it. Other parents would often tell their children right in front of me they shouldn't play with me because I only had a mum and not a dad. Even the teacher I hated once said to me, "It's because you only have a single parent. You're going to look more unpleasant as you get older as well." Kiyomi-chan was the only friend I had at the time who understood me. And so, perhaps it was my desire to see her again that made me dream of that day 2 weeks ago. I was sitting at Kiyomi-chan's kitchen table, just like that day. The table was covered in paper and colored pencils. There were also two Korokoro comics that I'd brought from my house. They were quite expensive at the time, so Kiyomi-chan and I would take turns buying them and then read them together. From the kitchen, I could see into the 6-tatami-mat living room. Kiyomi-chan's mother was there, sitting on a green cushion as she watched TV. I could only see her from behind. It was just like the real thing, and in my dream, there were things that I'd even forgotten about while awake. Kiyomi-chan was drawing a picture of a cake, and then she colored it as I waited beside her with scissors, watching as she worked. Even though it was a dream, I knew that I was in a dream. Kiyomi-chan suddenly stopped and then looked at me. Then I said to her, "Kiyomi-chan, I'm 32 today." She looked at me, surprised, and then said, "You didn't forget, Buruburu-chan." She was half smiling, half crying. I fought back tears myself. It wasn't Doraemon's future, huh? Then the both of us cried together and burst out laughing. Then I woke up. I was in my 32-year-old body. I cried. It was just a dream. But I'd like to think that I traveled through space and time to meet Kiyomi-chan again, just like she did for me back then. It sounds fake when I write it down like this, but I've never told anybody else this story, and I don't intend to either. Strangely, I forgot all about her until I turned 32. I mean, we were only together for a short time, maybe 2 or 3 years. I've no doubt that I had that dream because I wanted to see her so much. But that day, Kiyomi-chan really said it was the year 2002. There are other strange stories surrounding her too. She was rather good at predicting things, or maybe she had great intuition. Come to think of it, she might have even had a Doraemon. I don't know if it was in the Korokoro comics or not, but something like that used to come with these cards. A single sheet where you could cut the cards out. And she put them all face down on the floor and was like, "This is Nobita. This is Jaiko." She could honestly get 100 correct in a row. There had to be a trick to it, but I had no idea what it might have been. "I can see through them if I look closely," she once said. I live in California now, so I'd love to get in contact with her again and visit Las Vegas. I've been sullied as well now. This is what it means to be an adult. I moved away in the 5th grade, so I don't even have our elementary school graduation album. There's another story, at the risk of you all making fun of me, that involved Kiyomi-chan making it rain for me. I honestly believe she did. On this particular day, notices were given out regarding an upcoming excursion. We were going to walk 2 hours to a large park with a picnic area. Now, kids usually love excursions, but I was feeling rather down because something bad happened to me on the last trip we took. All the other kids had these lunchboxes that were all the rage at the time. They were pink and red with Sanrio characters, and inside they had octopus wieners, Hamburg steaks, etc. They were really cute. But because I came from a single mother family, we couldn't afford a lunchbox like that. All I had was my dead father's crappy square silver box. Of course, the contents were nothing fancy either. "I don't want this!" I screamed, not even thinking about how my mother might feel. "Go buy me a red Kitty-chan lunchbox, and put wieners in it too." "I'm sorry," my mother said apologetically to me. "I'm so cruel, aren't I?" At lunchtime during the trip, we were split into groups to eat lunch, and Kiyomi was in another group. I tried my best to hide my lunchbox with the furoshiki wrapped around it as I ate, but even that had a design meant for older men. And of course, there was one girl in the group who was like the leader of the bad kids, and she set her sights on my lunchbox. She grinned and whispered to the girl next to her while pointing at me. Then that girl turned and whispered to the girl next to her, like a phone game. Everyone around me, about 6 people, burst out laughing at once. I wanted to disappear on the spot. It was a bit of a long story, but anyway, that was the reason why excursions equaled hell to me. Apparently, Kiyomi-chan saw that from a distance, and when we got the printouts about the next trip, she must have understood how I felt. "I don't want to go on this trip," she said to me. "School is more interesting, don't you think?" "I don't want to go either," I said immediately. "Those girls are mean." "Well then, let's pray it rains," Kiyomi-chan said. And then, on the night before the trip, I watched my mother take that square metal box out as I went to bed, horrified. The next morning, it was pouring rain. Like, so much rain that everything had turned into small rivers nearby. I was so happy to go to school. Of course, the trip was cancelled. "Kiyomi-chan, it really is raining," I said when I found her. All she did was smile back at me. Next up features a countryside village with an interesting legend. It's said there's a creature that will steal children away if they don't do as they're told. Naturally, some kids want to mess around and find out. See what happens in Gosha. people who are into the occult might know a similar story to this, so I'm gonna write it down. In the countryside where my great-grandfather was from, there's a legend passed down of a yokai called Gosha. Apparently, people would say stuff like, "If you don't do as you're told, then Gosha will come and eat you up." I lived in a pretty remote area myself, so when my grandfather got angry at me one time and said the same thing, I asked him, "What's a Gosha?" In the end, he didn't tell me anything, so I asked my father instead. "It's a monster that makes noise as it comes during the night and steals children away," he said. That night as I was in bed, I heard what sounded like some bicycle brakes squeaking outside several times. "Is someone outside?" I wondered, and went to get up, but my grandfather pushed me back down into bed. This noise continued for several days, and the shutters were closed tight, even though it was the middle of summer. When I was younger, I was genuinely scared, but when I was in the final years of elementary school, I was more like, "That has to be some weirdo riding around during the night on their bike." My friends from the neighborhood seemed to feel the same way, and nobody really believed that this Gosha creature was real. So anyway, we were also told that Gosha wouldn't do anything bad during the Obon season. This is the setup so far. During the summer holidays of my 6th grade, I went to stay in the countryside with my grandfather for a while, and I had to take part in their Bon Odori dance. This dance was held in a small square in front of the neighborhood council hall, and on this particular day, even the parents would overlook it if the kids stayed out a little later than usual. It was just like, "Well, it's dark and dangerous, so don't go up into the mountains." A child drowned in the reservoir up there a few years earlier, so that area was off limits. Then one of the neighborhood kids, who was kind of like the leader, said, "Now's our chance. Why don't we do a test of courage?" But not to the reservoir, but rather the shrine at the foot of the mountain. It was a small shrine, with only a gate and a small building, and the grounds were pitch black. "Let's explore it," we decided. So, with the oldest kid in the 6th grade, and the youngest in the 2nd, we set off with a group of about 7 or 8 kids towards the shrine. It was a country road, so the distance between the streetlights was rather large, and honestly, on the way, I wanted to go back home. Some of the younger kids started to cry, and I was like, "Let's go home." I turned back right before the road that led to the shrine. Nobody said a thing, and they all followed me. As I was walking along, thinking that my parents were going to get angry at me for being out so late, I heard a creaking that sounded similar to the brakes on a bicycle. "It's Gosha," someone whispered, and then one of the small kids started crying. The older kids grabbed the younger kids' hands, and we all ran back towards the dance site. The whole time, the sound followed us from a set distance away. The creaking sound disappeared around the same time we heard the drums from the nearby dance, and I was so relieved that I cried as well. I think it was around 10 p.m. by the time we got back there. The grown-ups thought we were sleeping at home, so they were pissed. Up until that point, we were all together, and although we didn't arrange anything together beforehand, not a single one of us said anything to our parents about the noise we heard. The next morning, however, there was a big fuss. My mother told me that the leader boy had disappeared. He'd gone home after that and fallen asleep in his own room. But when his parents woke up the next morning, his bed looked like it hadn't been touched, and by the time they were done with their morning radio taiso, they started to think that he might be missing and put out a search request. In the end, they never found him, and rumors started to spread that he was taken by Gosha. They searched the area around the reservoir carefully but found no signs of him, and while I was staying at my grandfather's house, I kept hearing that creaking sound night after night, so I was terrified. I haven't been back to his house since then. Well, I went back there just once about 5 years ago for my grandfather's funeral. "You're here," my relative said, surprised, and made me return home that very same day. It was then that I heard they found the leader boy's skeleton a short while earlier up in the mountains. But they didn't find his entire skeleton, and no matter how hard they searched, they couldn't find one missing leg bone. Sometimes I think that if we had told them about the noise that followed us back from the shrine that night, then the leader boy would still be alive. Gosha might have been nothing more than a famous weirdo in the area, and when I think about that, it's really tough to handle. But the good news is that no more children have gone missing since then either. Our last story for this week features another small countryside village, but this one under the thumb of a Yamamba. Why? Find out in Yamamba Belief. My hometown is a village on a mountain full of beech forests. There is a somewhat large city at the foot of the mountain, but there is only one road leading down to it, so we don't interact with them too much. Our village doesn't have a doctor, so if something ever happens, then we have to go to the town at the foot of the mountain. Despite all this, that illness managed to find its way to us. The Spanish flu rapidly worked its way through the village, killing villager after villager. My grandmother, uncle, and younger brother all died. Every day it was yet another funeral. On that note, there is only one shrine in the village, and no others. Because the villagers are supposed to help with all the funeral preparations and stuff, they were all rapidly reaching their limit. Yep, the famous Spanish flu was prevalent in my hometown as well. Everyone was talking about doing something to ward the evil off at the next month's village meeting. In our village, we don't just follow Shinto, but we also have believers in a Yamamba as well. According to legend, since long before the Heian era, a Yamamba lived in the mountains. She lived there long before anyone else did, but when people started living in the area, she attacked them with a group of Tengu. The village chief at the time begged her to stop and handed her a family heirloom, a mirror. This mirror has been passed down in my family through the generations, and if you look into the mirror and chant a spell, then you will be able to see whatever you want, he said. The villagers also agreed to build a shrine for the Yamamba at the top of the mountain, and so she took control of the village. She watched over and governed the villagers through the mirror. If someone did something wrong, people would threaten them by saying the Yamamba would come down. During the Heian period, when the Yamato people attacked, the Yamamba saved the villagers from being massacred. After that, belief in her grew. That's how the legend goes, anyway. And so, exactly 1 month after the start of the lunar calendar each year, the villagers visit the shrine and perform a Kagura dance to ward off evil. But this particular year, due to the war, there weren't enough people to do so, and so it was cancelled. And then the Spanish flu hit us. We moved into action. We gathered all our relatives who moved to other places and decided to perform the Kagura. The remaining villagers gathered at the shrine on the day. We lit bonfires and the mood was glum. Yet still the villagers were full of hope. Maybe, just maybe, this will help us. Then it began. The sound of flutes, drums, and other instruments played. The performance of the godlike Yamamba and her Tengu continued. I was but a small boy at the time, but I was glued to it. For some reason, I cried. Then the Kagura ended. The evil was dispelled. Nobody caught the flu after that, However, the priest who played the role of the Yamamba died 1 week later. And that was that. From my grandfather's diary. Don't forget to pick up Korobana Volume 9, available on Amazon right now. And check out our newly revamped merchandise store at korobana.store. And if you'd like to chat about this week's stories, come and join us in the Korobana Discord. You can find that link in the description or on korobana.net. You can also check out our Patreon at patreon.com/TaraA Devlin for exclusive bonus stories and extras, or our YouTube channel at youtube.com/KorobanaJapan for all sorts of Japanese horror you won't find anywhere else. Thanks, guys. Stay safe, and I'll see you again next time for even more Korobana, true Japanese scary stories from around the internet. Want even more scary stories? Head over to korobana.net for new translations every week. You can also join our Patreon for exclusive stories you won't find anywhere else. Head over to korobana.net now.